Thank you, choir. So the choir is singing these words, where do we come from, who are we, and where are we going? And as we are sort of in the middle of our 139th year in this community and getting ready to launch into this theme about crossing boundaries, it seemed like a really great question to ask. Sometimes we get so busy hurrying along, doing whatever it is that we're doing at the time, we forget to stop and look back and remember just where we come from and who we were at that time. This year, as we explore crossing boundaries as our theme, I think it's important to look at exactly why that's important to being a Unitarian Universalist, just what it is that informs our faith that makes this an important part of this spiritual journey. Often people come to church because they are seeking like-minded people, and crossing boundaries is much more complicated. So it's so more comfortable to hang with people who are like us and have similar backgrounds and education, who we understand and feel comfortable with. So why do it at all? Why should we even cross boundaries? Let's take some of our time today to explore the rich history and thinking about why our Unitarian Universalist ancestors chose to cross boundaries. Unitarian Universalism has a very long history, and actually for most of their existence they had two separate histories, I could bring up stacks of books about all the history, so I could stack them all up here. So we're not going to cover all the history by any stretch of the imagination today, but I think both have shared this idea that it was the deeds and not the creeds that form our worth. And so today I'll just explore some moments in history that talk about that and what it had to do with crossing boundaries. I wanted to start by thinking about what was happening with the Universalists, the time in which that group of people in Waterloo decided that they wanted to create an organization back in the year 1875. So let's think back to life here in Iowa in the 1870s. Now we know, if we think about it, that houses didn't have electricity back then, and of course there were no automobiles or refrigerators, and so it was a different kind of life here in Iowa for people. And many of the settlers to Iowa were coming directly from Europe and just learning English and what it meant to be an American. Civil War had ended just a mere 10 years prior, and its effects were still very strongly being felt around the country, and the Civil Rights Act was just forming due to Reconstruction. Now, Waterloo, which was incorporated in 1868, now that's, do your math, that's only 7 years before the Universalists were organizing. It was a center for flour mills and sawmills, so people who worked with their hands were at the center of it, and those who ran the companies. Herbert Hoover's wife, Lou Henry, was born in Waterloo in 1875, while he was born in West Branch, Iowa in 1874. And right here in 1876, in Cedar Falls, UNI was founded as the Iowa State Normal School. And so that's what was happening at the time the Universalists got together. And if you read our history, you can see that this vibrant frontier community attracted some, you guessed it, free thinkers, who wanted to be able to go to a church despite their alternative views on religious concepts. And they decided to found a church with progressive views, a church where communion was open to all. This choice was definitely crossing boundaries of society. Can you imagine what the other churches thought as these people gathered to form a church? They call that a church? You can only think, huh? So, starting in 1805, we'll learn a little bit about the Universalist thinking this way. They have this document, their guiding document. It was called the Winchester Profession. Now, you might think, how like those old stuffy Christians of our past to have a creedal document. But what you might not know is actually prior to 1805, there really wasn't such a document. And the only reason they wanted to have this document, the Universalists, was because there were some states that were still collecting taxes for the sustenance of the, in capital letters, local church. Read not Universalist in this case. And so the Universalists in those states couldn't get away from paying tax that would pay for some other church unless they could prove that they belonged to a different religion. And of course, the civil authorities didn't abide the thought of a religion that had no statement of belief that separated them out from that general Christian community that those taxes were going for. So after much debate, and finally, some good consensus, all in the town of Winchester, New Hampshire, so that's why it's Winchester. This confession was adopted. I'll read it to you now so you can hear it. This is what it says. We believe that the Holy Scriptures of Old and New Testaments contain a revelation of the character of God and of the duty, interest, and final destination of mankind. We believe there is one God whose nature is love, revealed by one Lord Jesus Christ, by one Holy Spirit of grace, who will finally restore the whole family of mankind to holiness and happiness. We believe that holiness and true happiness are inseparably connected, and that believers ought to be careful to maintain order and practice good works, for these things are good and profitable unto men. That's it. Now, please note, amidst the Christian-sounding language, some very interesting differences. Namely, the A in front of the word revelation that refers to connections to the Bible. Also notice that the whole family of mankind will be restored to holiness and happiness, not just some select, not just those who've said certain words or professed certain kinds of faith or done certain things. And finally, the justification for doing good things and maintaining order is not because God's going to get you if you don't. It's because it's good and profitable unto men. Now, you know, be charitable to our ancients and read humankind here where we say men, because obviously English has shifted, but these are radical differences from your average Protestant or Catholic church of the day, where fire and brimstone and salvation and being damned were really quite the norm, and where the Bible was infallible rather than a revelation. Interesting, isn't it? Now, shortly before our church was formed in Waterloo, the Universalists had ordained the first woman to the United States, to the ministry in the United States, Reverend Olympia Brown, in 1863. Choosing to be a Universalist in the time that our church began meant choosing to belong to a rather radical organization. Here's a small excerpt of Reverend Olympia Brown's writing on the state of women at the time, just to give you a sense of the tenor of what was being talked about then. She writes, "It can be of no possible advantage to a man that his mother is a social toy, financially a dependent, politically a slave. On the contrary, the stream cannot rise higher than its source. And if women are fettered, dependent, ignorant, their sons will be narrow in mind, cravenly, and cowardly. When women are free and independent, and by experience of the business world shall have grown into the stature of true womanhood, then indeed we may look for a race of noble men, such as the world has never seen. The larger woman's experience is, the better she is fitted for every duty, the more intelligently she can take any position to which she is called." As you can see, the Universalist faith propelled those people right up to the boundary of what it meant to be legally a woman in this country, working for women's suffrage, but also uplifting the whole idea of women's role in our society. And this, my friends, is crossing boundaries. Can you see? They were really right up there on the edge. One of the most famous Universalist women who crossed many boundaries in her life was Clara Barton. She was born in 1821 and who was, as you may know, the pioneer nurse who founded the American Red Cross. And in addition to being a hospital nurse, she had worked as a teacher, a patent clerk, the first one hired by the U.S. government who was a woman, and a humanitarian. At a time when relatively few women worked out of the home, Barton built a career helping others. Before her father died, Clara Barton was able to talk to him about the war effort, and they decided that it was her duty as a Christian to help soldiers. She returned to Washington to gather medical supplies, and the Ladies' Aid Societies helped in sending bandages, food, and clothing that would later be distributed at the war front. She asked and asked to be there on the front line to help the men who were coming back, and the stories were so gruesome about what the war was like. And finally, in August of 1862, she gained permission from Quartermaster Daniel Rucker to work on the front lines. Yes, she was the only woman on the front lines. She was right there in the medical tents helping to hold down people as they had to have their legs cut off, you know, because of gangrene and no medical care. She gained support from other people who believed in her cause, and she worked tirelessly during the war to distribute stores and clean field hospitals and apply dressings and serve food to wounded soldiers in close proximity to several battles. And she was later appointed by the Union General Benjamin Butler as the lady in charge of the hospitals, end quote. And among her more harrowing experiences was an incident in which a bullet tore through the sleeve of her dress without striking her, but killing a man to whom she was tending. Yep, she was that close to the battlefield. She was known as the angel of the battlefield, and stepping into a man's world of battle, carrying love. Now that is crossing boundaries, isn't it? Although our own early history is universalist, the Unitarians were also very busy at the same time frame. And it is often said that the merger of these two faiths happened because the two separate churches found themselves at all the events and the meetings and the protests and the labor that was involved in moving humankind forward to being more loving and more just. And if they kept bumping into each other, maybe they ought to work together. So if the Universalist set aside a sense of needing to worry about salvation and felt that they should roll up their sleeves and get about the business of being good people, the Unitarians, having set aside the doctrine of the Trinity, found themselves always struggling as a marginalized people, and this made them ever champions of freedom and tolerance. From the time that our one and only Unitarian king, John Sigismund of Transylvania, not only tolerated but fostered religious diversity in his kingdom, in 1568, John issued the Edict of Torda, which is this broad decree of religious freedom, and it was the first in the history of Europe. It supported the establishment of the Unitarian Church as well. But he encouraged respect for and an open dialogue between all religious viewpoints. And he even sponsored public debate between Catholics, Lutherans, Calvinists, and Unitarians. Other religious groups in Transylvania, including Jews, Orthodox Christians, and Muslims, were granted legal tolerance, but not necessarily legal guarantees of freedom. So it was a big step forward in this culture of Europe when people were routinely being tortured and burned for not complying with the religion of whatever king was currently reigning on their little bit of turf. So this is a radical boundary crossing by our one and only Unitarian king choosing to do something very different than the way it had been done around him. The Unitarians in this country over here in the United States have not always been as quick to move towards social justice, perhaps because in general they were educated and fairly wealthy people of New England who spread across the country in university towns as they were established, while the Universalists were in general laborers, factory workers, and farmers. There are stories about during prior to the Civil War, when the Unitarians and the Universalist churches over in Boston were only about a block apart, and the Universalist guy was preaching anti-slavery, and the Unitarian guy was preaching pro-slavery. So we're not always been on the same page historically. But I think over time, because the Unitarians were more established in society, they tended to be well-positioned to work towards social policies and laws that favored a progressive society, while the Universalists, often living closer to the suffering of society, were willing to step out and work with the hurting and the marginalized people of our society. They're both very valid ways to spend your life's effort. And yes, in our own history, here in the Cedar Valley, the Unitarians were established as a group of interested UNI faculty members and their spouses in the 40s, and they had a little living room group that grew and blossomed, and if you want to hear all about it, you should talk to Donna Kroger. She's not here today, but find her, because she was there from close to the very beginning, or maybe the very beginning. And I can't tell you all about them because our time is limited, but they were very interested in the causes of the day, and during that those first years of our Unitarian group, they played a strong role in the civil rights era protests and the anti-war movement protests, and even the women's rights and women's liberation movement that came along in the 70s. These both echo movements that the Universalists had championed a century before. And so it seems life goes on as women's rights are again coming up into question. And the Unitarians, our group of Unitarians, thought of themselves mostly as humanists. And so they championed causes because they felt that they lifted humanity up, and that was the reason to do this work. Now, some of these things that I've talked about are things that have been done by individuals, but other things have been done using our Unitarian or our Universalist institutional strength. One of the most powerful institutional movements that I've seen in our history were in the early 1900s were incredible boundary crossing experiences as the settlement houses were set up in many urban areas. I'll give you one example. In Minneapolis, the Unitarian House was a social settlement. It was organized to be a center of educational and humanitarian work. The plan included a kindergarten, a day nursery, read childcare there, a savings bank, and evening Americanization classes for recently arrived immigrants, economics, bookkeeping, mechanical drawing, and other studies. Social hours were scheduled each weekend with addresses and talks on topics of current interest. And although the Unity House was organized to be non-sectarian, and the Methodists and the Lutherans cooperated, the Unitarians and the Universalists took the lead in the management of this institution. So many things we can do when we work together as a group to create social change if we're willing to cross boundaries. I can't even begin to hint at all the various things that Unitarians and Universalists have done over the years, but you can think about homes for aged and the infirmed, of orphanages, of our Unitarian Service Committee that resettled so many Jews and other refugees during World War II. We've also advocated and worked tirelessly on issues of child labor, of temperance, of tenement house conditions, of civil rights and gay rights and environmental causes. Out of our early efforts for the Universalists came the theological understanding that the gospel asks us to spread God's love. And in the early 1880s, the Universalists, along with some other Protestants in this country, led what is now known as social Christianity, or the social gospel. And we still share this sense of working towards spreading God's love with some of the other progressive Christian communities in our society today. The assumption was that poverty and other social ills were not misfortunes without a remedy, but the result of ascertainable causes that could be identified and removed by human ability to solve social, economic, and political problems. It's interesting to think about this theological teaching in light of our current political conversation about poverty, isn't it? Now, for the Unitarians, these efforts that I've been talking about over our history really came to strengthen the vision of American humanism and ethical culture, which was rising out of the theological understandings of Unitarianism. And this is a way of saying that we humans are born good and beautiful and without sin. And human, as humans, we have this potential that deserves to be given its full possible flower. They're slightly different theological views, as you can see. Some have shortened this to say the Universalists believed that God was too good to damn us, and the Unitarians believed that we were too good to be damned. It's a nice brief way, if you like short things. It's a little bit, toopathy in some respects, but it'll do, because it's important to realize that in the end, both cases bring us into stepping forward and crossing boundaries. And as I reflect on our history, I think that as a group, we Unitarians and Universalists have had less of a tendency to want to roll up our sleeves and jump into the trenches to help. As time has passed, I think we've become a little bit more comfortable sometimes as a group. We'll go out and work as individuals in the social sector, but I think we've somehow lost our sense of working together, that we could be leaders for social change and social justice in the world. And I hope that in thinking about our history today, that it will begin to add a sense of past and rootedness as we vision this year for the future. That we will see the power of balancing feeling at home with like-minded people, and stepping out into the world to encounter things and people who are quite different from us, carrying our conviction that all are loved and worthy of love. I hope that we will strive to become so much more active and willing to cross boundaries as a group of Unitarian Universalists. So I'm going to close with this story here. So once a man came to a town, and he asked the local sage, "I'm thinking about moving here. What kind of people live here?" The sage asked the man, "What kind of people live in the town where you came from?" He said, "Well, where I'm from, the people are liars and cheats and mean-spirited." The sage says, "Well, the people are the same here." Then another man came to the town and asked the sage the same question, "I'm thinking about moving here. What kind of people live here?" The sage asked the man, "What kind of people live in the town where you are from?" He said, "Well, where I'm from, the people are wonderful and kind and courteous." The sage said, "The people are the same here." You see, people are not so much as you see them. People are as you are. We're not really ever able to be an objective observer of the people of our lives. We are a subjective influence. In other words, our presence changes what we observe. We Unitarian Universalists have a lot of power in our hands and in our feet if we choose to cross boundaries into worlds of people who are different from us and bring